Hello and welcome to the Sunday Salon, the podcast that celebrates brilliant books and the women who write them. I first interviewed Kelly Greenberg Jeffcott back in February 2020, and then the pandemic hit in earnest. We weren't sure what to do, whether to ignore the fact that half of her answers now felt out of date or to do it all again. I'm so glad we went for the latter because I wanted to hear how the pandemic experience had affected her life, creativity and writing style, especially because, as a US national, she spent the whole year miles away from her family. Of course, that's not all we talked about. She also told me about the incredible level of research that went into her epic debut novel, Swan Song, which imagines the fallout among Truman Capote's group of female friends when his expose of their private lives is published in Esquire, as well as the differences between writing for page and screen, and how she tackled the writer's block that almost scuppered the book. I loved revisiting our conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Kelly, welcome. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to chat. I'm excited.
So, as I've already explained, this is actually our second Sunday Salon interview because I recorded an interview with you just before the pandemic really sort of hit the UK and before
the world fell apart.
Before the world fell apart, although I mean, presumably quite a lot of the falling apart was already underway, but we didn't know that. We were blissfully ignorant. And then I put the whole kind of regular podcast on hold and started these isolation casts, the kind of lockdown specials. And then when we were chatting over email, we just thought rather than airing the original episode, let's record an update because I know so much has changed for you and you've had some really interesting projects in the interim, but also, you know, a huge part of your previous life and process was travel, which presumably it isn't anymore. So before we get to Swan Song, which I do want to ask you all about, I wonder if I could just ask, what has your year been like? What's your 2020 been like? Because it is basically almost a year since you were sat in my kitchen having coffee and talking about writing to me.
Absolutely. We were just saying it's astonishing to think that we were sitting next to one another and sharing a cup of coffee and tea and in the good old days. It's just been the most surreal time. I feel like it's played with one's concept of time passing. I feel like some days it feels as if it's been 3 weeks. Some days it feels as if it's been 3 years. As you mentioned, travel was a key part of my life. I live with my husband in London, but we also have a home in Los Angeles, and my parents are in Texas, and we're back and forth, and that's just halted. And so that's been really challenging. And in fact, I had planned for the first week of April a trip to the States where I was going to go to the Library of Congress in DC to research Book 2. And so I had this massive research trip planned, and we were going to go see my family afterwards and check in and have meetings in Los Angeles. And it just all halted. And when the U.S., there was a weekend period where they had announced travel bans on a Friday and said, but not the U.K., and we could feel that it was coming. And by the Monday, then it included the U.K., and my husband and I sat at the kitchen table and said, do we just go to the airport and get on a plane and risk it? And thankfully, we chose not to do that because there was such a mad rush of expats trying to get home that, you know, there were horrific footage of people, thousands of people stuck in, you know, a handful of airports in the States, of course, with no social distancing and no masks. And so we didn't do that. But it's been the longest we've ever been in one place, unable to get to family, unable to get to other homes and concerns. And it's just been utterly surreal.
And what about creativity during that period? How have you found, because you do, and you know, listeners may not be aware of this, as well as writing fiction, you also, well, write another kind of fiction in the form of screenplays. So how have you found being creative in lockdown?
I think once I let go of the pressure to emerge from this period with the next war and peace. I think there is this great pressure that we're at home all the time. We can't even escape to go have a nice long lunch. You feel like every day you need to be churning out pages and emerging with a novel of epic proportion. And in the beginning, I found it very crippling because I felt, what is there to write about but this, but the times in which we are living and that we now find ourselves grappling with? But I don't think we have perspective yet to be able to write about that. And you start to think, will all literature be about pandemics? Will everything have to involve this? And I think once I realized that we don't necessarily have to change our plans as far as what we want to write, the stories we want to tell, but our experiences can't help but be colored by this period of time that we've survived. I remember feeling this way after 9/11 in the States and thinking, oh my goodness, I can't possibly continue on with the projects that I was passionate about because they in no way deal with this situation that is consuming our every waking hour. And I think once I realized all stories are still valid and there will be great works of art that emerge from this period that won't be dealing with it directly, but will in some way be colored by our experience. I mean, I've turned to a lot of literature that was published after the 1918 Spanish flu, and you just see this wealth of creativity that came out of it. I was rereading Mrs. Dalloway. There's a great nonfiction book called Viral Modernism. And so I've been returning to a lot of the work that came out of that situation. So I took refuge in research. I found that initially I couldn't channel voices. I'm a writer that's very voice driven, and I was finding it difficult to do that. But I found that the discipline of research was very helpful and that the creativity sprang from that. So it took me a while to get back to finding my literary voice. And I would say that I did it through returning to books that I loved and really diving into research in a way that it allowed me to recover those voices that had been dormant for a bit. I did have a very extraordinary thing happen. A television series that I had written 12 years ago that I developed an entire first season of and devoted most of my early to mid-30s writing while I was researching Swan Song. It had, back in the day, come very, very close to going into production, and one component fell through, and as such things happen, the whole project fell spectacularly apart. And at the beginning of lockdown, the producer that had originally championed the project got in touch with my agent and said, I really feel it's time for this show to be made. Let's do this. So throughout this period, I've been returning to a passion project from a decade ago and rediscovering it. And we had a Zoom pitch and pitched Warner Brothers, and we just signed the deal last week. So that's been a bit of a resurrection of a passion project, and it's very exciting. And I never would have thought this is how that project would finally come to fruition.
That's brilliant news. And it's really interesting because you have form with these long-term passion projects, which you persist with and persist with and persist with and have patience with, and which then come to sort of fruition in quite a wonderful way. And You did that with Swan Song. I mean, you worked on it. It was like 15 years that you spent working on that book. And then to publish it as your debut novel to such acclaim, to be longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction and to win the McKittrick Prize with something you'd worked on for so long. Can you tell me a little bit about, well, first of all, why was it so long? What was that process? And secondly, how did you keep yourself going through that period?
Well, it was 14 years total writing Swan Song, and it was 10 years of research. I was, of course, writing other projects, other screenwriting projects, while I was conducting the research. But it was a narrative that I initially thought of writing as a film or a television series, the story of Truman Capote's epic betrayal of the inner circle that he called his swans, these very powerful icons of the mid-century jet set period, who he saw as these novelistic heroines. But when I tried to write it as a screenplay, there was so much that would be left out, and so much of the story that I wanted to tell was not just the act of literary betrayal, but I wanted to give the women their voices back, that in a sense, if Capote had used them as the subjects for his last great novel that was never published because of the devastating fallout, I wanted to write a book in which they reclaimed their own narratives. And I felt that to do that, I had to have the knowledge to feel that I had the authority to speak in their voices. So it was years of researching everything about these women. It was years of studying Capote's work, because I also wanted to pay homage to his writing in a metafiction way. I wanted to come as close as we possibly could to having a version of Answered Prayers that was never published because it destroyed Capote entirely. So I wanted to study his technique. I wanted to know everything about that world. So it just, it became this monster of a research project. And it was something that was much bigger than a single standalone film or even a long form television series.
Did you ever lose motivation or lose, because you had no guarantee at the end that anything would come to anything. I mean, it was just pure, you're doing it on blind faith.
Absolutely. I kind of think of myself as a writer as being a marathon runner rather than a sprinter. And I just knew that the story needed to be told. And I knew that it would dictate how much time it took. It's not something that I plan to do with every book, but I feel that there was a version of that book that I could have written in a year, year and a half, 2 years, but it would have been a very, very different book. And the book that it evolved into is something that required that time. And it required me to live with those characters and those voices and that text. And it's going to sound a bit California hippy dippy, which is not me. It needed to tell me how it wanted to be written.
So one thing I'm really interested in, given that, you know, it was such a kind of long process, is what your trajectory was and is in general with writing. Like, if you do such research heavy work, at what stage do you move from, say, just doing research to plotting things out to actually starting writing and kind of make those calls? Or do you have an idea of the plot when you're doing your research so you can direct it? Can you just explain your trajectory to me?
Yes. Well, with Swan Song, again, I felt that I wanted to pay homage to Capote's work and to restore the voices of these incredible women that he betrayed in his fiction. And I felt that to speak in their voices, I really needed to know everything about them. I needed to study Capote's writing style so that I could create sort of metafiction homage to this enormous last work that was Capote's Swan Song, that was not finished because the fallout from this scandal so destroyed him. So it took a decade of really diving into everything that he ever wrote, everything that's ever been written about any of them. And then finally, I decided it was time to just stop, as my husband says, walking around the edge of the swimming pool and dipping a toe in, that I just needed to dive in and do it. And I think the fear that one has is, especially with a subject that is fictionalizing real people, what Capote did with In Cold Blood, what he called the nonfiction novel, is finding the voice. And so that was the challenge. And after the 10 years of research, I didn't plan that it would be 10 years. In fact, I was still researching the book while writing it the next four. I was researching the book until the day before I delivered the book. So the research never goes away. For me, research can be a crutch or a springboard. And for me, more often than not, it's a springboard. But in 2014, I had the series that I mentioned had fallen through. And I thought, you know what, this is time. It's time to switch gears. And so we were spending a lot of time in Los Angeles, and we moved back to London, and I started writing first pages in a workshop environment it's now defunct, but The Guardian and UEA used to do a masterclass collaboration, a 6-month masterclass. And mine was led by a wonderful novelist, James Scudamore. And so it was really in throwing myself headfirst into a workshop environment and just playing around and trying to see, okay, I now have every fact that I could possibly need, then some. And it then became about what is the voice of the novel. And to me, if the research is there, then the creativity kicks in how the story is going to be told and how you discover those voices and how you bring them to life and not become a slave to the research. And that's what the masterclass process really set me on the path of doing. And I think what I learned from writing this book is to plan is to fail. That some of the greatest discoveries of this novel, had I sat down and made an outline, which I actually did in the beginning, and all of the great discoveries of the book, had I stuck to the initial game plan, I never would have allowed those ideas in the door. And those ideas are very much what the book became. An example is I went in with a very clear vision that I wanted to tell this story from the point of view of Capote's swans and to gag him and allow them to use him as their subject as he attempted to do with them. And early on, this choral voice emerged in my work subconsciously. And James Scudamore and I had discussed how we had a shared love for Jeffrey Eugenides' debut novel, The Virgin Suicides, which is told from the collective perspective of a group of teenage boys in suburban Detroit. And while that book utilizes that technique in a very different way, what I was writing while I was trying to write in close third person from the perspective of these women, it was emerging as this sort of collective, judgmental, bitter voice of the betrayed. And it was the perfect device for a novel that's rooted in libel and slander and betrayal. And so I went away and I tried to ignore this thing that was emerging because it wasn't my plan. And I thought my on paper plan was so great, I just needed to stick to it. But I went away and I decided to write one chapter from this collective perspective to prove what a terrible idea it was and get back to my original game plan. And I think I left it till 2 hours before I had to leave for a workshop and deliver pages. And I sat down and started typing. And what emerged was chapter one of the novel as it is published. And I like to say that it wrote itself. It was one of those charmed moments that we all hope for that are so elusive, but it really did just, that was the voice of the novel, and it emerged. And I thought, fantastic, this is what it was meant to be all along. So I thought, great, I know what I'm doing. It is a first person plural narrator that I'm dealing with. And a couple of months in, my fellow writers in the workshop kept saying, well, where are the Capote chapters from his point of view, from his voice? I said, no, there's still the original game plan. He's still on mute. And then I thought, what am I doing gagging one of the most interesting figures of the 20th century and certainly the most interesting novelist of his age? And so I went away and I thought, how can I allow him into this world and not let him dominate it? And so I had the idea to write a chapter of Capote as a young boy, because so much of what he did in life can be drawn back to his childhood. He was abandoned by both of his parents, and his psychology was very much linked to needing the love and approval that he never had from his parents. So I wrote a chapter in his childhood world of rural Alabama, where he grew up next door to Harper Lee, which is extraordinary to think. And that came very, very easy. I am a child of the South. I'm a Texan, but my maternal grandmother was from a little town outside of New Orleans. And so from her, I feel I inherited the gift of the porch chat and the yarn spin. And so that came very quickly. And it took about a year before I realized, wait a minute, whether he's 5, 15, 25, 55, Capote is always that little boy with those insecurities and that flawed psychology. And so he basically strong-armed his way into the book as well. So I continued for about a year and a half writing the book with these two voices, with the Swan Chorus and Capote as the boy man throughout. And then it was when I was finishing the book, I thought, on the UEA master's course, that I hit Easter break and I developed the most crippling writer's block I've ever known. And Capote-esque, can't finish the book, terrible, terrifying writer's block. And I was actually too scared to tell anyone, my agent, my editor, my peers, that this was going on, my husband. And finally, one day he said, "I know you're not writing." And I said, "Yes, I am. I'm writing lots. I'm writing a great deal." And he said, "I live with you. I can hear when the keyboard is tapping and when it's not." And in trying to articulate why I couldn't write, I found what the missing piece was. And that was that I felt that my original plan of wanting to restore these individual voices to these amazing women had been compromised by the group narrative voice that was so vital to what the book had become. And so I said to my husband, "I feel like I'm doing the very thing Capote did to them. And that society did to them. I'm lopping them all together as his swans. And I'm denying them their individual voices. And they're stuck in this chorus and they want to break free. And they need solos. They need their own songs." And my husband very sweetly picked up a stack of note cards and a pencil and said, "What songs would they like to be singing?" And then I sort of had an exorcism of ideas. And it became clear that each of them, all of the research that I had done on their individual lives and habits and likes and dislikes and the worlds they inhabited, that's where that knowledge came into play. And of course, Morella Agnelli, who was married to the Fiat car chairman Gianni Agnelli, who was a famous rake, who was known as the Rake of the Riviera, would be an Italian opera, that her solo, if she were to have one, would be a Don Giovanni, a jet set Don Giovanni. And Gloria Guinness, who is famously tight-lipped about her mysterious past until she married Lowell Guinness of the Guinness Brewery family, she was from Veracruz, Mexico, and had potentially been a Nazi spy during the war and had a very shadowy past that she would only reveal in bits and pieces. And so I found a form of Mexican folk balladry called a corrido, in which a hero is painted in their heroic, carefully selected exploits. Cece Guest had been a chorus girl in the Ziegfeld Follies and then had been a muse to Diego Rivera, who painted her nude, and then had been a starlet at Fox for Daryl Zanuck. And so her life was really told in acts. So then I got to go back and look at the original Ziegfeld Follies program that she had been in, and that became the vehicle to tell her story. So each of them had their own very obvious song, as it were. So that was then the third piece. And none of that was in the original game plan. And it was only in departing from what I thought the novel was that I found all of the components that led me to eventually tell those stories in the way that I had originally intended, just not using the form that I thought.
And what about the actual kind of writing process for you? Do you have any sort of rituals or routines? Do you have to write at particular times of day or be in particular places? I mean, I know that you were traveling a lot while you wrote Swan Song, and in general do travel a lot, so presumably you can't be too tied to one particular routine, but anyway, tell me about it.
Yes, I wrote Swan Song on the road. My husband is an actor, and during a great deal of the writing process in the beginning, he was touring with the Almeida Theater's King Charles III. And so every week or every 2 weeks or every month, we were in a different town or even a different country. We ended up in Sydney, Australia, but we'd been all over England. And so I had a body bag size suitcase full of research books that I would schlep from one city to the next. And set up shop in a new place every week. And so it was oddly appropriate for writing a book about the jet set, although far less glamorous than their travel schedules and means. So it was very much on the road. And as far as where I write when I'm writing, I always write sitting cross-legged on a sofa with a pillow on my lap and the laptop on the pillow. And I have the most beautiful desk in Los Angeles when we're there in a library room with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, and I've never once sat at that desk to write. I have a fantastic desk in London that I never sit at. So as long as there is a sofa and a pillow and a plug and a laptop, I'm good to go with a iced coffee or a cocktail sitting next to me. So I don't have any preciousness about where I write, other than it has to be a sofa. But as far as a routine, I would love to be the kind of writer that had a set schedule, and I have the luxury of not having to. I really do write any time, and some of my best work is done at wildly inappropriate times, like 3 or 4 in the morning. So maybe one day I can become very organized and that will suit me. But I feel like because I'm a voice-driven writer, it's really about using that research as a springboard, and when the voices emerge, capturing that. And from that, then I feel like a lot of structuring and figuring out what it is happens after the fact. And that discovery process, even when I know what the rules of the book are, it's still very inspiration driven. And in fact, there is a story about the penultimate chapter of Swan Song, which was what I wanted to be, an homage to Capote's last great work that he did not complete, Answered Prayers. And I had sat down, I would say, at least 5 times a week for 4 years and had a stab at writing that chapter. And I knew what it needed to be. I knew what its function in the book was. But I also knew it was an enormous ask to do it well and to do Capote's lost work justice. And I would sit down several times a week and start typing and realize, nope, not it, and move on. And I was quickly approaching my final delivery deadline, which was September the 1st. And it was August, and I was in a house in the middle of nowhere in rural France, and my parents were in Houston, and Hurricane Harvey was hitting my hometown. And so I was desperately worried about them and watching this deadline approach. And my editor was even saying, you know, we don't necessarily need this chapter, but I knew that the book that I wanted to write really hinged on having that Capote's experience with that book in that penultimate chapter, his relationship with his art. And I was in France and I Googled the latest news in Houston, and there was a photograph of a string of giant swan floats evacuating kids from a property about 10 blocks from my house. And there was something about seeing that photograph. It suddenly came to me that the musical theme, we spoke about how I found the swans' voices through these different musical solo chapters, the musical theme that would dictate this Lost Answered Prayers chapter was Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. And suddenly the entire chapter opened up, and this thing I had been trying to wrap my head around for years, I wrote in 48 hours. So I feel that that's the kind of inspiration that you really can't plan for, but I think it's what makes for the richest writing often.
And can I ask a little bit about how you got into writing to start with? Because, you know, as I mentioned, you know, you're a novelist with a successful book out and another on the way, and you're also a very established screenwriter. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood and sort of how you first got into screenwriting, which is in itself a highly competitive industry? I mean, screenwriting is a dream in as much as, you know, writing a novel is a dream.
Well, I grew up in Texas, as you said. I was an only child, and I was a voracious reader. I just adored literature. I lived with my nose in a book at the library. I had read every classic by the time we got to it in school, and I was a history geek. I was obsessed with any time period except for the one in which I was living. So for me, the world began any time before the 1970s in which I was growing up. And I had an equal love for classic cinema. I adored the auteur films of the 1930s and the 1970s, which I sort of saw as mid-century cinematic bookends. I loved MGM musicals. I loved basically the films of the past, but I also had a complete obsession with the art of adaptation. I was always fascinated to see how a writer would translate a novel to film and create a new original. I was never very interested if it was just, let's put the book up verbatim on screen as it was in the novel, which I think happens with wildly popular books. To me, it was always more interesting when the screenwriter was able to create a new original that was in dialogue with the source material. And so that's something that I really wanted to do. And so that became my obsession. I used to say I wanted to be the Gen X Merchant Ivory or my generation's Anthony Minghella, and I'm still working towards that. But I think that to me, the two disciplines have always been a mesh because of this interest that I had in adaptation. I've adapted Tolstoy and Chekhov, and I just find the process fascinating. And I think there was a great interview that took place around the time The English Patient was released. And it was an event in Los Angeles with Michael Ondaatje and Anthony Minghella talking about The English Patient. And someone in the Q&A raised their hand and said, you know, I loved the film, but Mr. Ondaatje, I just have to say that scene in the bathtub with Catherine and Amishi, that was one of the most moving scenes, and I've always remembered it, and I adored it. So thank you for writing it. And Ondaatje kind of chuckled and he said, well, I would love to take credit, but that was all Anthony. And I thought that was just so brilliant that those two works were so perfectly two facets of the same idea, that the reader slash viewer had remembered a scene as having been in the book as opposed to the film, and it was actually the other way around. And when Minghella wrote the screenplay for The English Patient, he famously went to the Isle of Wight with tons of research books, but the one book he didn't take was the novel he was adapting, because he wanted to write his way back to the source material. So that's something I always found fascinating. And I knew that I wanted to be a novelist. I always wanted to be a novelist, but I thought I needed to get there. I needed to be ready to do that. And if I have any regrets, I think that I could have tried to do it sooner. I wish that I could go back and have a decade of books that I've written, but I think I would have written a very different debut novel had I written Swan Song when I was 25, 30, as opposed to when I did.
Yes, that's very interesting. I always find it fascinating when writers who started later in life, and you know, I mean much later than you actually, I mean people like Isabel Allende or Kit DeVal, you know, when they talk about whether or not they regret starting writing novels later, they never do, because, you know, as they say, you know, exactly what you've just said, your life kind of makes your work and shapes the kind of writer you are. Can I ask you, just on a similar theme to the sort of screenwriting, novel writing thing, what are the main differences between writing novels and writing screenplays? I mean, it sounds like a stupid question really, because obviously they're completely different disciplines, but I guess, how do you experience them differently? How are they differently sort of emotionally and kind of creatively for you?
I would say the major difference is that screenwriting or dramatic writing is collaborative writing. That no matter what you put on the page, it very quickly ceases to be the writer's baby, that there's going to be a director that brings their vision to the project. There will be actors that bring their interpretation to the project. There will be designers and producers. Everyone has ideas, and it's wonderful in that regard. It's very exciting to collaborate with a creative team, and that has its own energy and excitement. But for me, what's so wonderful about writing a novel is that you are not bound by any practical concerns. It's really the writer's playground. It's limitless potential to explore and play and invent, and nothing is constrained by a budget or a schedule. If you wanted to add four extra scenes to a 60-minute television episode that wouldn't be able to air. Whereas if you wanted to add 10 pages to a chapter, you can do that as long as you don't deliver a 600-page draft, as my first draft of Swan Song was. Then one's editor has something to say about that. But while I enjoy both, I think it's so liberating writing a novel because your imagination is in no way dictated by other factors.
So you've obviously been working on both at the same time recently. You mentioned that you were doing the Warner Brothers screenplay, and I know you're working on your second book as well. What's that like? I mean, how do you jump from one to the other, and how do you plan your day? Presumably you can't just decide to do what you feel like. You have to be a bit more structured. Can you tell me about that?
Well, this lockdown period, or semi-lockdown as we're now in, has been really fascinating because it's the first time that I've ever pursued both disciplines at once. So I spend part of the day lost in this marvelous world of research and playing in that infinite field of imagination of the novel. And then I spend another part of the day thinking, right, how do I tell X amount of story within the framework of a 60-minute episode? And so they require very different parts of the brain and methodology, but I think they inform one another. And I think I am a stronger screenwriter for the play that goes on while writing the novel. And I feel that the discipline required by the dramatic writing is helping to structure my ideas and my core concepts for book two. And on top of that, it's fascinating that I am adapting Swan Song as a television series. So it's going back to that original idea of how do I now take this epic canvas and go from something that had no limits to distilling one's own work to its essence into these 60-minute structured episodes for a limited series. So it's the ultimate marriage of the two disciplines in adapting one's own work and having to step back and still have the passion that created the work in the first place, but to be able to now employ the ruthlessness in the discipline that will distill it into a much more concise cinematic version of itself.
So I have one final question for you, which you will be familiar with, because as I said, we recorded a pre-pandemic episode, and also I know you're a listener to the podcast. And that question is, if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think I would say there are no timelines. And by that I mean there's no age by which one should have achieved X or Y or Z as a writer. There's no set amount of time it should take to write a book. If it takes a year, it takes a year. If it takes 10 years, it takes 10 years. I was always very inspired by Donna Tartt, who's one of my favorite novelists, who wrote her first book at 28, her second book at 38, her third book at 48. And I think that was a source of comfort, but I think I was also very hard on my younger self, that there were stories that I wanted to tell and was eager to tell. And I think I was frustrated with myself for taking longer than I would have liked to bring those stories to fruition. But I think I would look back and say, some stories take longer. Some stories need time to evolve. And I would be much more gentle with myself about timelines.
That is fantastic advice. And what a wonderful note to end on. Kelly, thank you so much for your time. It's been such a joy to talk to you again. And I'm so glad that we got to do a sort of update. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And I can't wait to do another one in person with you at some point when the world returns to normal.
I know. Imagine in person. And to everyone listening, Swan Song is out now. So that's it from me. Thank you very much for listening to the Sunday Salon. Please do share your thoughts about the episode. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Alice Azania. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do think about leaving a rating or review. It helps other people find the podcast, and it's also extremely exciting whenever they appear. So Thank you very much. Until next week, goodbye.